All right, so continuing to talk in the direction of emptiness and its implications, we're talking about the perfection of wisdom in 8,000 lines. And we just did a kind of chunky sort of question response discussion bit here, fleshing out just some responses from the last few weeks. So I want to bring us back into the text, kind of one concept from the text here. And then just weave in a little bit of what we've been talking about here. Over the last few weeks, we've looked at this, the beginnings of the Mahayana in the idea that, you know, language is an unreliable descriptor of authentic experience, that the words for the practitioner and the path and the practice are all themselves empty, empty meaning unfixed, not possessing an eternal nature as an entity, as a separate, you know, self-contained entity. And the teaching that the Bodhisattva, you know, vows to save all beings, but only does so by recognizing that there's no such thing as beings to be saved. In the middle of the text, the book goes toward a couple of interesting statements. In a way, it has now said the core teaching, and it's not complex, right? The core teaching, in a way, is it's turtles all the way down, it's emptiness all the way down. So anything that you might get attached to that has a fixed nature, that is empty and should be recognized as empty. And that's true for everything, all the way down to the tenets of the path and the existence of beings. Everything as a separate entity is illusory in that way. Everything is radically a process. So the teaching itself is fairly simple. And then the text spends far more time putting a framework around that teaching than it does expressing the teaching itself, which is not complicated. And the framework is things like bodhisattvas are the ones who are not afraid when hearing this teaching. And one of the frameworks that the text goes into is a defense of how awesome this teaching is. And it goes into some comparisons that I think really are about, again, kind of undermining our idea of what's solid or real, but also building up an interesting argument for why this is the pinnacle of teaching, why this is the perfection of wisdom. This is the highest. And it goes something like this. Because it is wisdom that causes Buddhas to become Buddhas. Wisdom creates Buddhas. So the perfection of wisdom, Prajna Paramita, is also called the mother of all the Buddhas, right? She's a goddess. Wisdom is a goddess. Side note, also in right the Greek understanding of it exactly the same time, wisdom was a goddess, Sophia. In several traditions, wisdom is feminine. So that's true here as well. It's true in the parallel Hindu tradition. Saraswati is probably the parallel to Prajna Paramita in the Buddhist system. One of the parallels. So wisdom gives birth to Buddhas, and this is because what makes a person into a Buddha? And there's a kind of deep understanding that happens, right? If you look at what's let go in the enlightenment or awakening process, the fundamental thing that's let go is ignorance, avidya, not knowing or not understanding. When avidya is destroyed or uprooted, vidya, knowledge, or wisdom, prajna, the nya in prajna is the same as the nya in knowledge, jnana. And so the prajna, wisdom, the deep knowing, is the thing that shines forth when ignorance is destroyed. And the Buddha uses light metaphors over and over. He says, darkness was destroyed and light arose, as happens in one who practices. In the poems of the elder nuns, the Terigata, there's a phrase used over and over, that one of the translation is, the great dark was torn apart. The great darkness was torn apart. So there's the sense that the arising of wisdom is like a flash of light illuminating, right? So you can finally see. Seeing is the metaphor. I can see clearly. So wisdom gives rise to Buddhas. And here we are in the perfection of wisdom. So the perfection of wisdom gives rise to Buddhas. One of the background details of this is, like, okay, part of what it's saying is Buddhas are different from arahants, fully enlightened beings who learn from a Buddha, because they self-arise. They don't have teachers. They don't have other Buddhas as teachers in their final lifetime, but also because they have brought the perfections, the paramita, or paramis. It's paramita in Pali and parami in Sanskrit. The perfections in the Theravada, there's 10. In the Mahayana, there's 6, but they're a similar list. The Buddhas have brought the perfections to their full expression, whereas arahants may not have. Arahants learn enough to become fully liberated themselves. Buddhas bring the list of the perfections to perfection. And so Buddhas bring wisdom, which is the paramount perfection, to its fullness. Wisdom gives rise to Buddhas, and then Buddhas teach. So that's the background logic. Now the text comes in and says, okay, so if someone were to gather up mountains of precious gems and wealth of all kinds and fantastic, objects, as much as would fill the entire universe, and offered that entire universe of precious wealth to honor the relics of a Buddha, or to build a stupa, or to build stupas, that could fill the world system and honor them for a cosmic eon, right? It tries to find the biggest, most cosmic-sized gesture of faith and honoring that you could possibly think of. It says, would someone who does that have more or less merit, generate more or less merit than someone who learns one stanza of this perfection of wisdom and copies it and venerates it and recites it and memorizes it and teaches it to others? The one who venerates one stanza of the perfection of wisdom generates more merit than the one who does that in that cosmic worship of Buddhas. Why? Because the one worshiping the Buddha is worshiping a kind of secondary effect. Wisdom gave rise to Buddhas. So to worship the Buddha is to worship something that already has its own cause. But to worship the perfection of wisdom is to go all the way back to the source and to worship actually the thing that gives rise to Buddhas. And so this has a bunch of implications for the early Mahayana. One is that this becomes a religion of the book in a very different way than the early tradition, which was not, right? The Buddha never said, take the record of my discourses and venerate them. The Buddha did say, travel to these pilgrimage sites, and venerate these important places, but he never said, put the book on the altar. And this text literally says, one who copies down the perfection of wisdom and venerates the book, and memorizes a verse of it and teaches it to others. This one, generates an enormous body of merit, a great body of merit. And this is because you're going back to the source. And so the text and all of the later Perfection of Wisdom texts, the Diamond Sutra does this as well, spends many chapters fleshing out this, like, if someone did the great, pilgrimage for such a length of time, or offered up as many stupas as there are grains of sand in the Ganges, how much merit would they get, versus someone who memorizes just one stanza of the Perfection of Wisdom. And so, and it includes not just memorizes it, but teaches it to others. So it really starts to weave in not just the veneration of the book, but like, even if you only take up one stanza of this teaching and you learn it and you teach it to others, you're doing this extraordinary action. It also then says, if someone needed to go on a journey or find protection, one thing they could do is they could take up a stanza of this Perfection of Wisdom and memorize it and recite it, and harm cannot come to the one who is a devotee of the Perfection of Wisdom. So it says, poisons, weapons, and fire can't hurt them, that kind of thing. Bandits can't hurt them. This teaching went far. And before we deconstruct it into are we actually saying that this will magically protect you from, blades and bullets and fire? Yes, we are saying that. And it may or may not be true for you, depending on the strength of your faith or the strength of your magic or whether magic still works in the world, whatever you believe about that, the text is saying that. And some centuries hence, a Chinese pilgrim is going to be wandering through a marketplace, unsure of what to do with his life. And he's going to overhear somebody chanting the Diamond Sutra, which is a descendant sutra of this one. And he's going to say, this is the answer. And he takes that text and he memorizes it. And then he walks with that text all the way around the Himalayas from the Chinese coast, all the way west, and then all the way back east to the Buddhist pilgrimage sites. And he collects texts there and brings them back to China and translates them. And we are eventually going to get the summary text of this Perfection of Wisdom, which is the Heart Sutra, which in a few weeks maybe we'll do some chanting of so that you can have your protection spell. The Heart Sutra becomes not just a summary of the teachings, remember that the words are all empty, but it becomes a protection spell against harm. So you're reaching back to the quality that gives rise to Buddhas as the thing that you worship. And then you're reaching back to that also as the most extraordinary, powerful force in the universe. I mean, what could be more powerful than something that gives rise to Buddhas? Calling on that for protection. And then the text itself becomes a kind of talisman of protection. And if you want to really learn like the details of this, you can dig into a book by the scholar Donald Lopez called, I think, Elaborations on Emptiness. And it's several different essays on the Heart Sutra. One of which, for instance, details the use of the Heart Sutra in an exorcism ritual. If there's some ghosts or spirits haunting you or someone else that you need to get rid of, there's a long, elaborate exorcism ritual that at its heart involves chanting the Heart Sutra over and over many hundreds of times in this particular ritual setting. And so the text itself, the heart of the Perfection of Wisdom, which is what the Heart Sutra is, becomes this extraordinary magic spell. It starts to be called not a sutra but a dharani, which is a magic spell. And it's a kind of mantra, right? That starts to be used in these more esoteric or tantric ways. So the seed of that is in the veneration then of the book that this thing is, and the power of going back to the origin of Buddhas in the quality of wisdom itself, which again is a goddess. So then you have, this natural evolution in a way of wisdom as a mother figure, of prajna paramita, feminine perfection of wisdom as the mother of all the Buddhas. So then you get this cosmic maternal figure who gives birth to enlightened beings by herself being the personification of illumination or wisdom. So a couple of lines from that text to bring us toward closing. Oh, where to start? This part gets very dense. But here, I'm gonna go back to the bit about what is a greater merit? What generates a greater merit? Offering all this stuff to, to a holy figure or a place or venerating the perfection of wisdom. And this begins to touch into the one of the other perfections, which is the perfection of dana or giving. So this is in the beginning of chapter 5 of the text. Interestingly, in this whole middle part of the text, in the beginning of the text, it was the early Buddhist monk Sariputta or Shariputra talking with Subhuti, the Bodhisattva. In this section of the text, it's the god Sakra or Chakra. Sakra, and that's a version of, in Pali it's Saka, it's the king of the gods, and it's a variant of Indra, the thunderbolt god, the king of the gods in the Vedic system. So this is the Buddha talking directly with the king of the gods about the perfection of wisdom. So Saka says, consider two people. One truly believes in the perfection of wisdom, trustingly confides in it, etc. And the etc. means the expansion of that is, let me read it to you. This is the stock passage of a devotee of the perfection of wisdom. One who truly believes in this perfection of wisdom, who would trustingly confiding in it, resolutely intent on it, serene in their faith, their thoughts raised to enlightenment, in earnest intent, hear it, learn it, bear it in mind, recite it, study it, spread, demonstrate, explain, expound, and repeat it, illuminate it in detail to others, uncover it, its meaning, investigate it with their mind, who, using their wisdom to the fullest extent, would thoroughly examine it, who would copy it, and preserve and store away the copy, so that the good Dharma might last long, so that the guide of the Buddhas might not be annihilated, so that the good Dharma might not disappear, so that the Bodhisattvas, the great beings, might continue to be assisted, since their guide will not give out, and who finally would honor and worship this perfection of wisdom. This is in the this initial conversation on, greater would be the merit of the devotee of the perfection of wisdom compared to the person who builds, stupas made of the seven precious things. It would be greater than the merit of someone who would fill the entire world with such stupas, etc., etc. And so you can hear in the definition of that devotee, a devotee to the book. Like it's embedded in the definition that you're like copying it, preserving the copy, storing it, teaching it, preserving it for later times. And so then Sakka says, okay, so we're going to consider a couple people. We're just at the end here, but I want to read this little passage to you. The devotee of the perfection of wisdom, when they have heard this exposition, they will resolve that they will never abandon this perfection of wisdom. Surely, so greatly profitable, so great an advantage, so great a fruit, a reward, endowed with such great qualities, that they will guard and preserve it because it is exceedingly hard to get. And they themselves will honor, worship, and adore it. The other person, so here's one person, the devotee of perfect wisdom, the one we just read. But now, this is not just compared to the person who builds stupas, but here's another person who would first venerate it and then give a copy of it to another child of a good family who desirous of it and eager asks for it. Which of these two persons begets the greater merit, the one who intends to give it away or the one who does not? Of course, you know the answer. The answer is the one who gives it away. And so, embedded in the definition is not just that the devotee venerates the perfection of wisdom for themselves and stores it and copies it and all that, but also the one who gives it away. And the language here is really like who gives away a copy of the book. And it comes back again and again in a way to the beginnings. Remember, this is the very beginning of literacy in India. The canon itself has been oral tradition up until almost this moment. And then suddenly they're saying, there's a book. You should copy the book and give a gift of it to someone else who will appreciate it. And so this becomes part of both how the system spreads and how it becomes a kind of magical or ritual, or talismanic kind of object. And so, the book is this book that we're reading from, The Perfection of Wisdom. And you could think of it then as any book that that contains the perfection of wisdom teachings. So, the clear if you want to give a gift of that, if you want to do what the text says, why not do it this week? Order from your favorite bookseller a copy of, the Diamond Sutra or the Heart Sutra or the Perfection of Wisdom and give it as a gift. But the thing I want to end with here is to turn this whole conversation about emptiness and the emptiness of language back toward kind of to go with the text from that initial philosophical exposition. Where it goes is into to really building out a kind of devotional system. And it's a devotional system toward toward the book, but then toward the concepts contained in the book. And we begin to just venerate wisdom itself as a kind of goddess. And this is going to turn slowly, continually toward a kind of tantric understanding, a very great vehicle kind of understanding of what wisdom even is. Right, that even to think of wisdom the way the early tradition thinks of it as a kind of individual illumination that arises in one person as a result of practice, that concept itself gets blown wide open here because the bodhisattva gives rise to a mind of enlightenment that encompasses the entire cosmos. And then they venerate the source of enlightenment itself, which is this unbounded, unfixed wisdom quality that's so vast that it could be called a perfection. And so then there's the veneration of that at the heart of the action of the bodhisattva. And what you'll see here is that the Mahayana turns from here more and more toward a devotional system, that practice becomes vaster and vaster in its scope. And the only way to make a meditation practice vaster is to include more beings in it. And so the great vehicle becomes bringing your mind to the kind of vastness that you could encompass the entire universe of beings in one flash moment of time not being a linear stretch, but all time and space collapsing into a meditative moment of profound inclusion of all beings, because all beings are empty. So just to take a little weave there between the philosophy of emptiness, the development of the religion of the Mahayana in this book and transmission of the teachings, and then the way that this is going to flower as an orientation toward the liberation of all beings based in vast states of mind that have a devotional quality at their heart. All right. Yes. So, all right. So we'll pause there. All right. More soon on all that.